supernatural is something that isn't supposed to happen, but it does happen.
And no nation which expects to be the leader of other nations can expect to stay behind in this race for space.
What does it take to convince you that the dead do not always rest in peace?
Broadsbeard Care is the proud sponsor of Three Beards Podcast. Go to broadsbeardcare.com, use promo code 3beards, enter with a capital B there, and you're going to get 20% off of, on all of his products, including our signature blend, 3B. Go to broadsbeardcare.com, and we all use this beard product. We absolutely love it. Check him out. Everybody, real quick, we're trying, just make sure you hit that subscribe, like button, just, you know, share this out so we can get these stories out to everybody, these amazing authors and guests. And at this time, if this botched, you know, ugly opening is not enough, we would like to welcome Mark Eddy. He's our secret agent booking man. He's joined us in here to help us out with this. And the guest of the hour is Scott Wolter. You know him. You've seen him on America Unearthed. I started getting ready for this. I started watching the show again, and it was one of those things. I think after doing this podcast, I've really started getting into a lot of these things more. And so watching those shows again really helped, because I was able to see him through a whole nother, you know, realm, which, you know, I wasn't able to do before. You know, now I'm like, oh, that makes so much more sense. And we, you know, so everybody's saying American Unearthed, that was you were on there for 4 seasons. You started out with History 2, and then you went to the Travel Channel in 2019. Now, are they, you know, welcome to the show. First off, Scott, are you still having me? Now, are you still doing episodes with Travel Channel? Because I saw just 2019. Are you just because of COVID, you know, kind of in hold?
No, as far as because of COVID, we're on hold. I don't know if we're going to come back or not. I mean, we've already been resurrected from the dead one time. We did 3 seasons in 2012, 13, 14, 15. And then we were put on hold because H2 was sold. And it was a strange time because the show was doing great. It was the number one show on the network at the time. And anyway, so they sold the channel. We never were canceled. They just took away our home network. And so my agent, I remember him telling me, he said, well, I don't know what network doesn't renew its number one show. And so we were waiting. I went and was co-hosting another show called Pirate Treasure, The Knights Templar. We did 6 episodes of that, and it was that was a great experience. And then at the end, they came back and said, History is not going to pick you up, Big History. And I said, why not? He said, and I'm not making this up, he said, because your show is too smart for History.
How does that work? I mean, that's the whole point of the History Channel, is you're supposed to be.
Well, you know, I have to say at the time, a lot of the programs that they had were, you know, and I'm not trying to disparage the content because a lot of people like it. And that's great. You know, like Ice Road Truckers and Pawn Stars is, you know, a really sick show. And but it's just not my cup of tea. And I just I think that, you know, my philosophy is if you raise the bar as far as the intellect or quality of the content, I think people will come. I understand you have to entertain, you have to make it understandable. I get all that. But I think there's an awful lot of people out there deeper, know more detail, and that's what we're proud to do. Who's that?
That was Austin's zoo on the other end there. It's like we're trying to get to his
Tega says the chaos is there. You know, just get, yeah, like that. That's where
we're at. Oh, okay. All right. Well, good, because we have chaos here, too. So, but anyway, so we were off for 3 years, or what was it? 16, 17, 18. And then at the end of 2018, we were approached to do another season. Travel Channel picked it up. The showrunner really liked the show and had been trying to bring it back for a few years. So we got to do 10 more episodes. And I thought they were some of the best ones we ever did. And to me, it was a bonus. And if we never come back, that's fine. I didn't think we'd come back the first time. So we were resurrected once, and it was awesome.
Yeah. I wanted to tell you, I was watching the Mayan Blue episode.
Oh, yeah. First episode
that aired. Yeah, I rewatched that, I really liked it, because one of the things that really resonated with me is, as we're getting ready for stuff, I'm doing research on it, and I was wanting to get you on this too. What do you think is going on that has got Georgia as such a focal point? You've got the Georgia Guidestones, you know, you've got the Mayans that have come over here, and they look like they have become the Creek Indian, you know, merged with the Creek Indian population. You know, they've took this clay from Georgia, took it all the way back there to make this Mayan blue. So there's something going on that's like hot, you know, they've migrated to Georgia. These guide stones pop up in Georgia. I mean, there's all these things that are happening in Georgia.
Right. Well, you know, I think you need to take a step back at first and realize, first and foremost, when people are dealing with something that is sacred to them, that is involved in ritual. And I know Chris can appreciate this. That takes things to a whole nother level of importance. And, you know, it really says something about the lengths that people will go to get what it is they consider sacred to do the work that they want to do. And so this Palygorskite clay was perfect for making this sacred Maya blue, you know, material that they would put on the bodies of certain people. They would use it to adorn carvings and artifacts. And I think you're talking about something that was, you know, very important to their culture. And they will go to whatever extremes they need to get what they want. Now, they did have some of this Palygorskite style of clay or type of clay in you know, that Yucatan part of Mexico, but in Georgia they had a ready supply of it there, so it became a trade item. And you know, to me, you know, if you look at, you know, the Gulf of Mexico, and you look how they could have just skirted around the coastline and then followed the rivers up to this area where they could get this clay, and it would have been an important trade item, and they would have had things down in the Yucatan that people in Georgia didn't have. I mean, this is what it's all about, right? And I think it's kind of insulting to the indigenous people of this continent to think that, you know, that they couldn't get around. My God, you know, boats have been around forever.
And, oh, yeah.
You know, and if you're hugging the coastlines, and maybe they sailed across and cut it short. I mean, they were in the Gulf of Mexico. I think that we are naive to think that these people were somehow not smart enough to be able to do that. In fact, the opposite is true. And again, if they want something that's sacred, that's important to them, they're going to find a way to get it, period.
Absolutely. So one of the things I looked up was your secret swamp people of Florida, obviously being from Florida. One of the things you said, or I can't remember what you said, was that the Smithsonian was hiding things from us. Why would they want to do that? And, of course, you asked the guy. He said, oh, we're not hiding stuff. I'm like, okay, yeah, of course you're going to say that. But why would they want to hide information and stuff from us?
Well, the reason they want to hide things from us is it's somewhat complicated, but it's really not, okay? I mean, let's just, you know, cut through the BS here, and let's just talk straight for a second. Who are some of the biggest deniers of the historical truth of this country? First and foremost, far and away more than anybody, is the Roman Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's just call it what it is. They don't want to have somebody else control the narrative. They've been controlling the narrative for hundreds of years, in fact, over 1,000 years. and they are trying to manipulate control people. I mean, that's what they do. Okay. And I'm sorry to the people that embrace that faith, but that's what's going on. And so the biggest contributor to the Smithsonian Institution is the Roman Catholic Church. So it follow the money, right? And so, you know, they embrace the narrative that Christopher Columbus was the first guy here. Are you freaking kidding me? The guy never set foot on what is now, you know, the continental United States. He never set foot here. And it already had millions of indigenous people living here. What are we talking about? He discovered what? Nothing. And so that's a false narrative. And the guy was Italian, right? He was financed by the Catholic Church. Give me a break. I mean, figure it out. It's obvious. Now, I've had experiences with the Smithsonian. They hate my guts because I'm the guy that said the Kensington Runestone was authentic. And they've been arguing, you know, for 122 years that it's a hoax. Well, it's not a hoax. And when I first did that work, I had no idea that there was a paradigm that there and you don't tread on that narrative. And I did. So I became persona non grata. Well, you know what?
Oh, yeah.
F them. You know, the date is the date of the result. No, I'm serious. I don't have time to use crap. So I've gone head to head with them and I say, look, show me the evidence or get out of the way.
Yeah.
Well, and that's what a lot of times it happens too, is just, you know, we've talked to a few people and you can see it when you have somebody who's got doctorates, master's degrees, all in these fields. And you have somebody like yourself that comes in and say, no, I found this and this proves this. They're going to clap back because you, Scott, has just told me my life's work is wrong. You know, and they're not wanting to let go of that, even though you've got an artifact here. This is not a forgery. This is an authentic thing. And this proves that Christopher Columbus, so, you know, that this narrative that's out there is not the case at all. Thousands of years prior to this event, somebody was here with this ability that did these things, built these structures, and they're like, No.
It's crazy.
And you're like, God, how many times do I have to show you something like the Kensington stone that's carved and I can do the dating on it and it shows this what that either time travel exists or there's people here before Columbus. I'm sorry. It's one of the two. You got to accept something here.
Well, actually, I think the whole question of time travel is something that maybe people need to relook at. I think that there might be a good argument that time travel is possible, but I get your point. And the point is that the runestone is authentic. And the problem that we have is as soon as you say that, it triggers a series of dominoes that begin to fall and they go to inconvenient places that institutions like the Roman Catholic Church doesn't want it to go. I'll give you a good example. Have you ever heard of the Talpiot tomb?
Yes.
Just last hour.
Okay, right. The Talpiot tomb, I hate to break it to people, that's been claimed to be a hoax as well. Or no, that's not the tomb of the royal family of Jesus and the rest of them. But it is. The evidence is overwhelmingly consistent with this being the burial place of the royal family. And guess what? There are bones there. There are human remains. And what does that do to the narrative that the church has been preaching for 1700 years? It blows it to bits. And the reason is, and again, I'm sorry to be offensive to some people. That's not what I'm trying to do. But, you know, in the world I live in, until I see a virgin birth and somebody rise from the dead, I'm not going to show me the evidence and I'll go there. So, I mean, this is, you know, pretty tough stuff for some people to grasp. I understand that, but again, the data is the data, the facts are the facts, and you know, science is one thing, faith is another. People are welcome to believe whatever they want, that's fine, but you know, I deal in facts and evidence, and I have to follow where the evidence takes me, and that's what I do for a living, and I'm not going to change the way that I go about investigating something just because it happens to delve into an area that some people are uncomfortable with. And I get that. And again, I'm not trying to be offensive, but
no, it is what it is. Yeah, and I've always lived, you know, I grew up, you know, Christian faith, you know, the thing as I've gotten older through this and other things, I've started really questioning things, because you can see how Christianity adopted all these pagan, you know, cultures into the thing and and took upon them, you know, this thing. So, you know, the Christmas holiday, the Easter holiday, all these things were pagan rituals, you know, and I really started going from the thing, especially with, I'm not frozen, am I?
Okay. No,
okay.
A little bit, but I'm tracking with
good.
You.
I just looked at one screen. I was just making sure that everybody can still hear me. But no, it's one of those. I believe I've kind of really gone to the thing. I would rather, you know, believe that, you know, if you believe in a God, that there he would want open, honest questioning, you know, of wise than blindfolded faith and fear. Because when I look at something,
absolutely,
this exists, but you're telling me that something that I can't see or something moved it over to this table and set it here for me. So that way I go, no, I want to know, how did that bottle get here?
Right. Right.
And
well, yeah. I mean, you're talking about something like a miracle. If that actually happens, there's probably a scientific explanation for it. Right. Probably.
Yeah. Yeah. There has to be, you know, cause we've all, you know, in the paranormal and stuff, there's always things that are going to be unexplained. You know, you struggle to find this actual, you know, thing to explain it. But when you get down to there is usually something that can be attributed to the actions that occurred. You know, and I've heard something like, you know, when Moses separated the Red Seas, I've heard the theory at that time, it may have been some sort of massive earthquake that created like a tsunami event that actually sucked the water back. And at that point, right, they crossed, and when they got across, the water came rushing back. That wasn't a spiritual, like here, it just happened to be that maybe through the universe, when it put them in the right place at the right time, and they were like, oh my God, the water's gone. Boom. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go. And they got across.
Or the whole story of the parting of the waters is allegorical. It has nothing to do with, you know, the real water actually being parted. It could have a whole nother meaning that has nothing to do with water. I'm not saying it is.
Oh,
I'm
no.
saying it could be. And in many cases, a lot of biblical stories are allegorical. They're not to be taken literally, but yet a lot of people do.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and that's one of those things. And that's part of the thing. Like, I really appreciate about your show, the way your wife, Alan, you guys have approached these things, because it's not, there's no thing like, nah, your idea is stupid. No, it's just, it's like, look, I get it. You think this is the thing. What I need to know is I want to know the hows. I want to know the whys. I want to know what this is. I want to know how this got here. I'm not going to just buy it's here. It just showed up. It just,
right,
you know, an angel put these tablets down here in this cave for me to discover on my show. And here it is, you know, and like, you know, the angel of the Lord came down and gave me this hooked X. No, I need to know who carved the hooked X into the thing. And there's a segue, you know, because that's one of your favorite subjects, because you even have a book about the hooked X, and that's the name of your website,
hookedx.com. Right, right. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, there's, I don't know, it's kind of hard to really go too deep into it without getting, you know, in the deep water yourself. But the one thing that I will say is, having, you know, been raised as a Freemason, I've gone through the York Rite, I've gone through the Scottish Rite, I've gone through some other orders that are what we call side orders. And I've learned an awful lot about allegory, symbolism, and code. It wasn't until I became a Freemason that I made a discovery on the Kensington Runestone that helped me realize that the person that carved that inscription was also initiated, because most of what's on the Kensington Runestone inscription is allegory. There are no 10 dead men, right? And so once you sort of have an understanding about that, you can look at the runestone in a whole different way. And if you want, I can tell you a couple of details, but it's really, really important to understand this. And I know Chris does, but once you sort of have a sense that this is what's going on with this inscription, you look at it in a completely different way. Now, on the runestone, there are 9 lines of text on the face side and 3 on the side for a total of 12. Now, those numbers are very important. 3 times 3 is 9. 9 plus 3 is 12. There's 12 primary constellations. 9 is an important Masonic number because it's divisible by one, or divisible by one number. 9 is also consistent with the Enochian legends in the Bible, the legend of Enoch and the 9 arches. And in fact, when I was going through one of the York Rite degrees in something called the Cryptic Council, and just to give you an idea, our degrees in Freemasonry are made up of part theatrical performance and part lecture. And in this particular degree, it has to do with a time period during Solomon's temple. It was actually at the end of the building of the temple. And they talk about the ark, and they talk about the 9 arches specifically. And I'm not giving away any secrets when I tell you about this, but one of the things that we learn in the theatrical part is that the 9th arch, which is called the Secret Vault, was built by the 3 Grand Masters, Hiram Abiff, Hiram King of Tyre, and King Solomon. And then in the lecture part, one of the white hats, one of the 33rds, was giving the lecture, and he said, and the other 8 arches were built by 22 men from Gebel. And I went, 8 and 22? Those are the first 2 numbers on the Kensington runestone. And I didn't hear another thing after the lecture. I'm like, oh my God. I mean, I'm probably the only person that's gone through that degree that picked up on those numbers and associated with the Kensington runestone. And all I can tell you is one of the most sacred numbers in Templarism is the number 8, and it's associated with the planet Venus and the goddess. And that's the first number in the inscription. And the rest of the numbers that occur embedded within the inscription add up to a total of 8. Is that a coincidence? Well, let's try this on for size. What's 8 plus 22, guys?
30.
Plus 2 shelters.
32.
32. 1 day
journey north from this stone.
You're going to get 33.
You've got the Scottish Rite degree system right there. Now, is that a coincidence? I think not. And it goes on and on from there. Hey, can I ask you guys a question? I'm going to put you on the
spot. Absolutely. Right now.
And Chris, don't feel bad if you don't get this right, because I've asked this same question in front of a bunch of Freemasons, and not one answer.
All right, here we go.
So, you ready?
Yes.
Yeah.
Would you guys agree that probably the most iconic symbol of our nation, the United States of America, is arguably the 5-pointed star?
Absolutely.
Yeah, like the Pentagon. And so, yep.
There's 50 of them on our flag, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
The Dallas Cowboys, that's their logo, right?
Right.
Okay, so, Dan Duke said 32 paths in the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. He's correct about that. And then the numbers, all those numbers, 8 and 22, and those are all part of the Kabbalah as well. So he's right about that. In any case, we're talking about the 5-pointed star. Now, be honest, guys, all of you. Mm-hmm. Do you know the origin of the 5-pointed star?
No.
No.
Star David?
Nope. And don't be embarrassed, guys, because nobody ever knows the answer to this question. But I find it incredible that this symbol, which is found everywhere in our society, in this country, it is the most iconic symbol of America, but nobody knows the origin of it, right? It's on the coat of arms of George Washington's family. That's where, on his family crest. That's probably where it came from. But the origin of the 5-pointed star is like everything else. It originated in the heavens, right? And it's associated with the planet Venus. And this is a scientific fact I'm about to tell you. Venus is the movements of the planet Venus are the most accurate relative to our astronomical observations from Earth. But as we view the movements of the planet Venus astronomically from Earth over eight Earth years, it will make the five-pointed star.
I know it now.
It's associated, it's associated with the planet Venus. Now, there's more to it than that. So just for a second, if you want to write down on a piece of paper or just do it in your head, make a five-pointed star. What is what's in the middle of that five-pointed star?
That is the should be the like the pentagon. It's pentagon, you know.
Pentagon, exactly. Mm-hmm. So if you take any one of those five sides of the pentagon in the five-pointed star, and you assign that length of
that's it.
Yep. Yep. Huh. Yep, it's a pentagon. Now, if you take any one of those lines in the pentagon and assign it a value of one, you know what the length of any one of those arms, the lines that make the arms of the star? Do you know what that length is relative to one on the inside? Mm-hmm. It's 1.618 something, something, something. That ratio of 1 to 1.618 is something called the golden ratio or the Fibonacci sequence. Have you ever heard of that?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mostly the Nautilus shell, you know, with the...
Correct. Correct. Yep. The most iconic symbol of the golden ratio is the spiral, right?
Yep.
And it's found in a shell. The rate of growth is found in plants. It's in us. A hurricane looks like what? A spiral, right? Mm-hmm. A galaxy is a spiral. When a wave breaks, it makes that same ratio. It's found in everything, not just on planet Earth, but throughout the galaxy. So it's a symbol of life, right? And who are the life givers?
The women.
Women, right?
Venus.
So that is why the planet Venus is the physical manifestation of the goddess in the heavens. She has always been associated with the goddess. Now, I will also tell you that if you go back in time in Freemasonry and to Templarism, it was all about the goddess because it was all about mathematics, geometry, and astronomy. That is why in Freemasonry, we call deity the great architect of the universe. And there's a lot more to it. The universe, G
stands. Now, if anybody thinks I'm being rude as I'm looking down as he's talking, it's because I'm in a master class right now and I am currently taking notes. So I'm over here. So as I look down, I'm sitting here. I've already been taking notes on the star and doing like this, you know, just, you know, this is the path, you know, just all the stuff. So yeah, if you see me down and you're watching the video, you're like, okay, why is he being so rude and ignoring his guest as he's talking? I'm like, because if I.
Chris, help me out. Why is Craig being so rude to us? What's up?
I know. I'm down here just. Yeah, I got you.
Scott, arithmetic actually comes up in Freemasonry. That's not giving away nothing.
Giving away anything. Look, if part of Freemasonry, look, when we talk about bringing light, that's just a code name for knowledge, for learning. And that's one of the things I love about Freemasonry. Is that you have an opportunity to learn things you can't learn anywhere else. But this is the most important thing. You're not forced to do anything, right? It's you. And you can take your Masonic journey. Isn't that right, Chris?
Chris?
Yeah, I mean, on a side note, on a side tangent here, Craig just thinks there's a whole lot more to it. But, I mean... Only thing that secrets that we know is allegory and stuff like that. But Craig, he seems to go on a tangent. There's got to be more to it. No, there's not.
He's like, I want you to join. I go, Chris, I don't want to join just the local downtown lodge. I go, I want to, yeah, I go, I already told you. I go, if I join, I'm not doing it because I want the Brotherhood. It's because just like the Da Vinci Code, I'm wanting to get to that top thing. And I want to find out what's in the basement in DC, in New York, and across. I go, because I'm sorry, right now, the local lodge, you know, all that's in that closet is a broom and folding chairs.
Hey, Craig, let me tell you something. If you join Freemasonry and you are a guy that wants to seek light and you want to learn secrets and you want to get to the bottom of the well, if you really, really want that, that opportunity is there. It is.
Yes.
Now, the Blue Lodge serves a very important function within Freemasonry and within their communities. A lot of charity work is done, fundraising. And, you know, I have to be honest with you. I'm involved in a lot of stuff beyond Blue Lodge, but I always go to Blue Lodge when I can, because I just enjoy hanging with the guys, because I can trust those guys. They're good people. And, you know, it's just a really good vibe. And, you know, going to lodge there's ritual there. And, you know, we're not, you know, it's not the Illuminati. We're not planning to take over the world. That's a bunch of BS. But I will say that it's a really good thing. And you will learn a lot. But it's like anything else. You get out of it what you put into it.
That's what you have to say to be the insider.
Well, I'm just saying. but seriously, if you want to go further.
Get to the Blue Lodge.
Oh, yeah. No, I get it.
It's hard.
Yeah, it's one of those. He's tried a couple of times. I told you, for me, if I do something, I'm all in. And I go, and I don't want to go into something as everybody is, just like for the potlucks and stuff, when my motivation isn't to just hang out at the picnics. It's like, I want to know. It's like, okay, yeah, that's great. All right, yeah, okay, cool. We did our thing. Okay, now what? You know, more.
Craig, you think I wasn't like you when I started?
Oh, I'm sure you were.
I wanted to know everything. And I will tell you this. If I had not joined Freemasonry, I had not gone through the York Rite, I had not gone through that Select Master degree, I would not have heard that White Hat say 8 and 22. And now I know for sure that this is a whole nother aspect to the room that nobody has ever heard of. I'm the first person in history to talk about it, and I'm not trying to brag. But I'm just saying that.
Wow.
And here's something that's really important that will resonate with Chris, and hopefully it'll resonate with you too, Craig. Because let me just be real with you for a second, okay? Before you are ready to become a Mason, you have to realize that you don't know it all. And the reason in Freemasonry that you are asked to make a statement about a belief in a higher power, and if you join, you're going to have to do that. Now, we don't care who that higher power is, what you call it, because whatever religion you are, that deity we're talking about, it's all the same thing, right?
Yep.
So it doesn't matter. But the point in saying that you believe in a higher power is to demonstrate humility, that you are not the end all. That you answer to something that's greater than yourself, whatever it might be. We don't care.
Exactly.
And that's really important. And I'll tell you why. And I wasn't ready until I was in my 50s, because I knew it all, right? I was a smart guy. I thought I had all the answers, but I don't. And nobody does. But you know these academics that have been saying that the runestone is a hoax? You think they're going to open their minds up? You think they're going to admit that they don't know something, that they have any humility at all? And the answer is no, because I've dealt with jerks for years.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're going to just by saying yes, invalidate your PhD that you've spent all those years on.
You can't say you don't know, right? Because it makes you look stupid. It actually makes you look smart, but they don't get that. But here's the other thing. And this is really, really important, because not all Blue Lodges do this, but in certain degrees that I've been involved in, we go into something called a chamber of reflection. and you're sitting in a room, it's dark, and all there is a candle. There's usually a Bible that's open to a particular verse. There might be a cross with Jesus on it. Sometimes it's not there. But what is always there is a human skull. And that skull is in there to remind you that this is where we're all going to be someday. And this person in this skull had a brain, had a personality, had a life, had a family, had all the things that we go through. Everybody does. But we're all going to end up like this. And it's to remind you that you came into this world with nothing. You're going to go out with nothing. And I don't care if you're the president of the United States or a guy, you know, working as a janitor or whatever. So it's really, really important to remember that when you, if you decide to join, if you don't have that mentality, don't bother.
Yeah.
Because you cannot receive new information until you're truly ready to receive. And that doesn't come until you are humbled. And that's it.
Nice.
Scott, with what you just said, and you were just talking just a couple minutes earlier about you don't know everything. In your books, you do talk about that a lot of this information is available. It's out there to be seen. And you draw our attention to, like, all those, like, M and W's in the roof lines of that Larbo church.
Larbo Church in Gotland?
Yeah, and all the different, M hand signs on some of the statues in the French churches. You make us aware that this information is present. We just don't, not all of us see it.
Right. So is your question, Mark, that am I revealing things I shouldn't be revealing? The answer is no.
We'll find out.
Yeah. No, that's one of the nice things about your book, though, is that you are making us aware that there's a lot more to learn out there. You're asking us to dig deeper, go to the next level, push yourself.
Right. But we're also giving people a helping hand, right? And, that was one of the things that I really love about the craft is learning about symbolism, learning about, things that are hidden in plain sight, right? It's the best place to see something is right in front of people. But it's until you have what we say is the eyes to see, until you know what the signs, symbols, and tokens are, you don't see them. And I just know that my journey has been so enlightening and so personally enriching and fun by learning about all this symbolism and that I want to share it. Now, there are certain things within Freemasonry that I'm not going to talk about because I took vows not to talk about them. You know, the code words, the handshakes, that type of thing, passwords, the penal sign that, I said I wouldn't reveal them. Now, if you want to find them, you can just go on the internet and look them up. But what fun is that? Right. As far as the rest of it, it's about enlightenment, it's about teaching, it's about learning and growing.
But, one thing, I don't know if you do this, but one thing that I really do is, we're talking about monuments and rocks and pillars and stuff. when you look at a building, you'll automatically see, yeah, this is Freemason construction. Or you'll look at the cornerstone. That's the first thing you look at when you go to any state. You're like, you're driving down the road on downtown, you're like, look at that cornerstone. What's the date on that cornerstone? When it was laid, you know, constructed, and you're like, okay, I mean, that's just me.
Well, no, listen, I'm with you, Chris, and that's one of the cool things is that you don't know what you don't know, right? And then as you learn about these things, especially in Freemasonry, and our country is just loaded, especially when you go back to the days of our founding fathers, you know, 53 signers of the Declaration of the 56 were Master Masons. You know, people always wonder that question. How many of our the signers of the Declaration were Freemasons? Well, damn near all of them. And so, you know, that influence of Freemasonry is still here. It's still happening. I've attended cornerstone ceremonies, and they're beautiful. And the ritual is meaningful, and it's just beautiful. But yeah, when you go around, once you know what to look for, it's like you can go into a sleepy little town in nowhere, you know, in America, and if you know what to look for, you can have a lot of fun. You go to the park, you look at the statues, like you said, you look for certain signs, you look for an M sign, and oh yeah, a brother did that, or you know, it's just cool. It enriches the experience, and it's fun to share it with people that you're with. Hey, check this out. I'm like, oh, wow, I didn't know that. It's cool.
Well, I know the actual documentary, you know, The National Treasure with Nicolas Cage, you know, it was an amazing documentary. You know, it was one of those, you always looked at that stuff, you know, because it kind of spawned a thing where, kind of like your show and other stuff where everybody's just like, ooh, I wonder what was hidden in this thing. And so when you guys are bringing up the cornerstone, what is, like your wife's book with Alan Hunt, yeah, Ellen Butler, is about the cornerstone of the White House. There's always been that rumor that something was, you know, surrounding that cornerstone. And during the text, that's why it suddenly missing, you know, is the true location, you know, cannot be found. And that's why I said, have they found, because everything else in DC was so planned, that was there something to this stone that, you know, possibly that's why it's not, you know, it's not found now. It's because it had to be actually, relocated.
I think it has been found. I think it was relocated. Okay. Well, don't hold me to that, but I'm pretty sure that it was. And I think what happened was, I know there was some remodeling that was done, major renovations that were done at the White House. I don't remember when, but you can look it up. And I think they did find it. Now, where exactly it is now, I'm not sure, but I don't know if there was nefarious going on there, but, you know, things do get misplaced. And sometimes, you know, people mistakenly will mortar over something. They'll cover up something beautiful. I'll tell you what, there was a stone that was found up in Nova Scotia that dates to 1606. And I can't remember exactly where it was found, but it was brought to a historical society, and somebody gave it to somebody else, and it ended up being mortared into the wall of a building, and then they plastered the whole wall. And it's like, to find it, you have to take away all the plaster, and they didn't bother. It's gone. My point is that it could have been accidentally lost, right? And it's really just misplaced. It's nothing nefarious is going on. I don't know if that's the case, but I'm pretty sure it's probably an innocent mistake.
Scott, with the solstice coming up, and you know, your birthday, and the Janet and Alan on Last Hour, you know, one way to show some kind of coherency between the two shows is you know, these celestial observations, and one of the places, you know, aside from Washington, D.C., that best exemplifies that is the Newport Tower. What are some of the medieval, early Renaissance secrets that are put into that structure.
Okay, well, first and foremost, the architecture is spot on. Medieval round church, Templar round church architecture with the eight round heavy columns, with the Romanesque, rounded Romanesque arches sitting on a second story cylinder. And if you look carefully at it, you'll see at the top of the columns, they have capstone ledges that were used to provide structural support for probably wooden beams for the first story ambulatory that was almost certainly there. And actually, there's been some post-hole evidence that was found about 11 years ago during an archaeological dig. There may be some more archaeology done at the tower. But that in itself, the architecture is just, I mean, that's Knights Templar Round Church architecture. You see at Cambridge, in Cambridge, England, in London, at Temple Church. And if you go to Portugal, in Tomar, Portugal, at the altar inside the church in the Chirola at the Convento do Cristo Castle in Tomar, which was a Templar city. It's the same architecture. So architecture is one, but it was not only built as a chapel, but first and foremost, the Newport Tower is an observatory because one of the guys that did more work than anybody on the astronomy at the Newport Tower was a friend of ours who recently passed away. His name is Bill Penhallow. He was a professor of astronomy at the University of Rhode Island. He was also a Freemason, and he was the one that discovered numerous solar, lunar, planetary, and constellation alignments within the Newport Tower. So, and there you go. You can see it right there. Now, Bill, I think, deserves the lion's share of the research and the credit for documenting these alignments. And when you understand the precision that was used to calculate these alignments and then build them into the structure, you know, what the current narrative is, this was a friggin' windmill. And
yeah, there's no way.
Ridiculous. And I'll tell you why it's ridiculous, because there's no steel reinforcement in those columns. And so the lateral forces produced by the shear wind shear on if this thing was ever used as a windmill would tear it apart in like a year or two. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's embarrassing to take that position. And there's a lot more. I mean, you know, myself, I published the Keystone Illumination on the winter solstice. It's going to be happening here in a couple of weeks. With the egg-shaped keystone, the only true keystone in the tower in the west-northwest archway that just so happens to illuminate when a light box that's created by the south window you had in that picture right there frames out that keystone that is a light tan-colored granite that just glows like a laser beam when the light box hits it, and it happens at exactly 9 o'clock in the morning only on the winter solstice. Now, what are the odds of that, right? Now, what's fun about that is it happens to be my birthday. I'm a solstice baby. So every year since we made that discovery, I go back there to see the illumination as a birthday gift to myself. Now, we were planning to go this year, but due to COVID and all the shutdowns and it doesn't look like it's going to make sense for us to go this year. But there's one more thing that I want to tell you about the tower. When you go to the outside of that same archway where the keystone is, back to back on the outside is a notched keystone, something called the Mark Master Mason's Keystone. Basically, when a structure was completed during medieval times, the honor of placing the final keystone in a structure was given to the master stonemason, right? The master mason. And what he would do is he would put little notches at the top of that keystone. And you've seen them. You see them in architecture all the time. And on top of it is a bright red granite orb sitting directly on top of that keystone. Now, when I was out there in 2007 and documented the illumination event, I was walking around to the outside of the tower, and I, as far as I know, I'm the first person to notice that Mark Master Mason Keystone. And I wasn't even a Mason then, but I was studying Freemasonry at the time. And I knew they were back to back. But what's ironic about those two keystones is they are not centered in the middle of the archway. No self-respecting medieval stonemason would do that, would they? So that means, logic demands, that they did it for a reason. It's off by 2.5 degrees to the south. And when I was standing there one day during that picture. You got it?
I said, I'm hoping.
Okay.
Is that the one?
Nope, that's not it. Nope.
I failed.
No, it's all right. We love
I failed you, Scott. Hey,
good try. Swing and a miss. But anyway, here's what happened. I was standing there looking at that keystone on the outside. And I'm like, I'm trying to figure out, why did they do this? And then I turned and I looked to the west and I said to myself, what are you pointing to? And then it hit me. And then I went home, I got on Google Earth, and bang. So check this out. If you draw a line from the center of that tower through those two keystones, the only two true keystones in the entire tower that are back to back on the inside and outside, not centered in the archway, and you extend that line into space, do you know where it goes?
Where the Kensington Runestone was found?
Boom.
Wow.
To the Kensington Runestone. Now, you can't make that up, right? Now, I know there's some people listening that want to call BS on this, but let me tell you something. There are a lot of people that don't like me, including the Smithsonian Institution. And do you think if they had an opportunity to pack it up my rear end, do you think they wouldn't have done something about it by now? My book has been published
absolutely.
For years. You know what I've heard? Crickets.
Yeah, I bet.
So what does that tell you? They're tied together. Whoever called, or I'm on something, one of the two.
Mm-hmm.
But what it tells you is whoever created the Kensington Runestone also built the Newport Tower. I said before I did the work on the tower that the Templars built carved the Kensington Runestone. And I know the Templars built the Newport Tower. Boom.
It might be in this book.
Oh, don't tell me. No, tell someone.
No, that's right.
No, you know what? In the cryptic code, I do a summary of all the research I've done on the tower and the runestone and the other artifacts that connect. But it tells a very important story. And in a nutshell, that story is that the Knights Templar, who were not who the Roman Church thought they were. Remember I talked about the goddess, the veneration of the sacred feminine?
Mm-hmm.
The Templars, the initiated Templars, pretended to be Catholic. Because you said it yourself, Chris, the symbols that the Catholic Church has adopted were pagan long before, right? Well, the Templars' ideology is before Christianity was ever around. They venerated the sacred feminine. And then when they were created, they pretended to be Catholic. They aligned with the Catholic Church. What do they say? My enemy's enemy is my friend. And so what happened was the whole Crusades was a military mission. The leadership captured Jerusalem so they could control that area of the Middle East as a command center. And they spent the next 75 years rounding stuff up, artifacts, treasure, relics, documents. They went into Egypt. They did the same thing. And they rounded everything up. And then when they were done, they didn't get defeated by the Muslims. They retreated and said, we're done. We're out of here. Because the long goal was always to establish the third temple, the new Jerusalem, America, they called it. So they took those treasures west into Western Europe and eventually into the British Isles. And then they dumped them over here in Nova Scotia and various places in the Great Lakes region and the St. Lawrence. And they buried those treasures. But here's the key thing that's missing, guys, and it's very, very, very important. When the Templars came over here, remember, it's about ideology. It's about belief systems.
Exactly.
Who did they run into?
Native Americans.
Native Americans. And guess what?
Exactly.
They're all matriarchal societies. They venerate the great goddess. So the Templars and they have this in common. They became blood brothers. They practiced rituals together. Did you know the natives have their own secret society? It's called the Medewin. Look it up. It's Freemasonry. And they've been practicing it for over 10,000 years.
Called what?
It's called the Medewin. M-I-D-E apostrophe W-I-N.
That's a new one.
We call it, basically, white people call it the Grand Medicine Society. But the natives, they call it the Medewin. So when they came together, how do you think the Templars got to Minnesota? They didn't fight their way here. They traveled with their brothers. And they went all over this continent. They went all over South America too. And it's because they aligned and they intermarried. Now here's the other thing. I'll drop another bomb on you. You know this bloodline thing of the Da Vinci Code? The Templars carried it in their veins because they were the descendants. And they put the bloodline in their indigenous brothers to protect it. Here. And what happened when settlement came? Genocide. And who is behind that genocide? Largely the Roman Catholic Church. Sorry, it's a fact. The Jesuits were spies over here, taking out as many as they could, because they knew one of the convenient side benefits they would get is eradicate that bloodline the Templars brought over here. And so they took those treasures and they handed that obligation on to our brethren, the founding fathers, who were all what? Freemasons.
Freemasons. Wow.
And they were also Knights Templar. They just didn't tell anybody. And they took that obligation. They knew about the runestone. They knew about the Newport Tower. They just didn't tell anyone. And they finished the job. And we're living in it right now. It's called the United States of America. This is that shining castle on the hill, right? Mm-hmm. That everybody talks about. And we were the ones that were the leaders. And I say were because we're not right now. Because we have lost our understanding of what our true mission was and why we were founded. Remember, who was it that persecuted the Templars? The monarchs of Europe, the king of France, right? And the church. Why did the church burn these dudes? Because they were pissed. Because they figured out that they weren't the good Catholics that they thought they were. They venerated the Virgin Mary with a passion. Why?
Yep.
Because to them, it was the goddess. And when the church figured it out, boy, they were pissed. And so, move forward to the revolution that was fought by mostly Freemasons. We fought a war against what? A monarchy, right?
Yep.
The English king. And we have freedom of religion in this country because of what? Because the Templars suffered from that persecution and our founding fathers knew all about it. And the monarchs would legitimize the church and vice versa. And when those two get together, you know who suffers? The people. And it's happening again, right now. And I'm sorry if I offend anybody, but I'm just telling it the way it is. This is not a Christian country. You can be any religion you want. We happen to have mostly Christians here. That's great. But we are not a Christian country. And don't ever forget that. Because the minute we do, we fall into that same trap all over again. And I'm sorry if I'm getting a little spun up, but it's because somebody's got to say it.
It's Chris's fault.
Say it.
It's Chris's fault. We're going to blame him. No, I mean, I get it.
It makes a lot of sense. Me and Craig acknowledged some the other day, and he's like, well, God says, I shall worship no other gods before me and after me. So Craig's favorite thing is to say, well, did he acknowledge that there was other gods at that time? And I'm like, yeah, absolutely, Craig. Well, I mean, you know, it's why would you say that if
as you're talking, just, you know, yeah. And it just, as you're explaining it, I was just thinking all the stuff that's popping in, the Westford Knight. I mean, all this stuff, just as these things come in, these things make sense, because as, you know, the Smithsonian and everybody else goes, no. You're like, how many things do we have to do that are supposedly outliers? You know, we can't keep throwing stuff in this outlier pile. It's getting ready to avalanche on top of you and bury you. All this evidence.
They'll never accept it. They'll never accept it, because they just can't. It doesn't matter how many artifacts you show them. They're not going to accept it, because it threatens their point of view. It threatens their power. It threatens their control. And that's just the way it is. And we see this playing out right now in front of us. And it doesn't matter what people say. It doesn't matter what people do. Once their minds are made up, that's it. And so, you know, that's why, you know, I'll be perfectly frank with you. I've been very concerned about the last 4 years, where truth, honesty, integrity just didn't seem to matter. Our environment doesn't seem to matter. You know, it's all about money. The more money you have, you know, you can buy happiness. Well, all I know is, what good is money if you live in a crap hole, right? And the other thing that I don't see enough
is
people that are trying to make the world a better place than they found it. People, I don't think, for some reason, they give it lip service, but they don't do what they should be doing to make the place better for their kids, their grandkids, and the ones we'll never meet. I mean, this world that we were brought up, it's a really cool place, but I've seen a lot of degradation and a lot of bad things that have happened in my lifetime that were preventable, because we as humans on this planet are not taking responsibility. And that's got to change. And I feel compelled to speak up, not just as a Freemason or as a person that has a platform, but as a human being. It's important. And we got to turn this ship around, or we're in trouble.
Well, it's kind of, you know, like we're predominantly, like I said, we stay away from politics, you know, just because it's such a hot potato thing with it. But we're going to have a guy, Charlie Robinson. He's going to be coming on the show in the beginning of the year. And he really hit on this thing kind of the way, the same thing like you talked about. Mm-hmm. And I've been trying to preach this, especially the last few months. If we really want to start making changes, we have got to drop this team sport thing. We have got to quit. This is my team. That's your team. Only my team. You know, it's like, we have got to start getting back to what the fundamentals were that founded this nation. This wasn't some elitist thing that this is the only way. This was founded on, like you said, they came over. The thing was freedom, you know, the ability to live your life the way you want to do. And we've gotten to this part where we're trying to divide ourselves back into these camps where if you're not in my camp, I hate you. I don't want anything to do with you.
You know, Craig, it's very simple. When I have this discussion with people, you know, obviously politics has been very heated in the last, you know, few years. It just has. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of polarization. Yeah. But the bottom line is this, is that we all eat, sleep, shoot.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying? And
yep.
I'm just saying, man. But here's the thing. I don't care if you're black, white, Asian, whatever. I don't care. Every one of us, when you cut, your blood is red, right? We're all the same.
Yep.
And I just don't understand why that's such a tough concept. You know, when I was younger, I was surrounded by racists. And I don't know why, but it just didn't make sense to me. I don't know why. I always found, you know, I played football with the first African-American when I was in high school, and I just found him so interesting, and we got along great, and I'd listen to his music, he'd listen to my music, and I learned from him. And then I played college football, and I played minor league football, and oh my God, I played with everybody, you know? And it just, you know, the thing about different cultures, and I've traveled a lot, I've been everywhere, right, all around the world, and I've met all kinds of people, and I learn from them. I love learning about new cultures and what some of their rituals are, and I'm like, hey, we do it the same thing. We just do it differently, and sometimes the way they do it is better, you know. And I'll tell you what we did at my daughter's wedding. We just had 2.5 months ago. They asked Janet and I to perform a ritual, and it was a Native American ritual. The Hopi Native tribe down in the Southwest. They have a tradition where you have this ceramic vase that's called a marriage vessel, and it's got two spouts on opposite sides, and then a handle in the middle, right? And basically, the symbolism is, you know, the pot represents their life together. This is the bride, the groom, and they're tying themselves together in holy matrimony to live this life, right? And so during the ritual, what we did was we had two little plastic cups on either side, and then you fill it up with the beverage of choice. I think they did whiskey or something. I don't remember.
There you go.
So the woman takes the first sip out of, you know, one side, and then if she's so inclined, she'll offer it to her husband to be. If he's so inclined, he'll take a sip. Then we fill up the other side. He takes a sip. He offers it to her. And if everything's going good, then you fill up both sides, and then cheek to cheek, they have to drink it at the same time. And there's the union, right? And it's a beautiful ritual. It's two people coming together as one. And if I hadn't learned from the Hopi this ritual, I wouldn't have known about it. And now a lot of people that were at the wedding said, I want to do that at my wedding. And, you know, it's cool, you know, cool. And it's native. It's just awesome.
No, that's, you know, and those are the kind of stories. It's like everybody's, you know, you'll come back to, and that's just, but that's going to be the thing that really people remember, you know, from the wedding, which is, you know, those are the memories that you want. I mean, everybody does the chicken dance, you know, that, like I said, you at the weddings, you don't have the, you know, those, everybody forgets all those, you know, silly DJ stuff. But, you know, when you have, oh man, remember that drinking ritual we did in the ceremony? Oh, yeah. That was a lot of fun.
Well, you know, I was actually an officiant at a wedding a couple of years ago. My son's best friend got married, and they asked me to do the ritual. And the funny part was, she was Christian, so we did the unity candle. Joey was Jewish, so, you know, we broke the glass, and then I asked him, I said, "Do you guys mind if we bring in this marriage pot ritual?" And they loved it. And I was so worried about Joey's dad. And you know, after we did it, I went up to Bob and I'm like, "So what'd you think, Bob?" He goes, "Oh my God, that was so great. I loved it," you know? And cool thing. So we honored three different traditions in one ceremony.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. You just, you have everything. You meet everybody, you know, all together. It's just, you get to break stuff, you get a drink, and you get to, you know, light stuff on fire. I mean, this is a party.
Bottom line is, you're hammered when you walk out of
it. Yeah, you have an excuse. What were you doing? Oh man. And then,
I see a good question here. Any update on the potential excavation of the Newport Tower? I don't want to give away too much here, but just know that that process is underway. And the guy who's spearheading it is a guy that was a guest on the last episode of season 4, a former Major League Baseball player. His name is Brad Lidge. And he is the most awesome dude you will ever meet. He threw the final pitch in the 2009 World Series. There's an iconic shot of him going to his knees. I mean, how many people can say they threw the last pitch to win the World Series? But he's a humble guy. He's really smart. And, you know, he studied archaeology the last several years of his baseball career. He pitched for 13 years. And, you know, he's one of those guys that wants to learn more. And he's told me at some point, I'm going to consider knocking on the door. So when that time comes, I look forward to his initiation. And boy, I can't think of anybody who's more worthy than him. Trust him that when he eventually gets his opportunity to oversee a dig, that he'll do a fantastic job.
That's great. But hey, you know, Scott, I cannot thank you enough for coming on the show. You know, especially, you know, just last minute too. That was great. That was, you know,
boss told him.
I was already one beer into it when Janet called me down and said, "Hey, they want you on the show." I'm like, "Oops, I didn't know that." But this worked out great, guys, and I appreciate you indulging me. And sorry if I got a little spun up, but
that's what we wanted. We wanted the real story.
That's what we like.
But I just think this is important. Yeah. You know, go ahead, Chris.
Do you ever come to Florida by any chance?
As often as we can, especially in the wintertime, man. Where do you live?
Right down outside of Orlando.
Orlando. That's where we fly in. We have friends that live in St. Augustine. And so, yeah, careful what you wish for, brother, because you might.
Definitely. Don't hesitate to reach out to me if you come to my city. We'll definitely show you a good time.
Love to do it. And if it's any near a lodge night, it'd be fun to check out your lodge and meet some of the brothers.
Yeah, we bring up these things. Like, so everybody, I need, you know, obviously Amazon's got them all listed here. But as we heard, a nice little teaser thing. If you go to Hooked X, there is a chance that you might be able to score a signed copy of your book.
Not a chance. I sign every book that comes out of that's bought on the website. Janet's book is there too. She'll sign it. And if you want to personalize to yourself or somebody else, we're happy to do it. Just let us know.
Yeah.
There you go. Look at that, Mark.
Yep. Cryptic code of the Templars in America, I think, might have been the one he was just showing up there.
That's
the latest one. Akhenaten and to the Founding Fathers, the mystery of the Hooked X, the Kensington Runestone, compelling new evidence. And you got the Hooked X key to the secret history of North America. You check out his, you can go on Netflix. I think Netflix is the one that has it, was where I found it. It might even be Hulu might even have it too, was where I was going through. But go check America Unearthed, catch all the shows, especially after talking with them. When you come back now, you can really, really see, you know, some of the stuff that we've been talking about. And it's really cool watching it come to life. And we had that same question. Any update on your newest book and when we're going to be able to get a signed copy?
Well, you know, the Cryptic Code came out a year ago, so that one's available. But I am working on the follow-up now, and it's really some great stuff. It actually will I'm going to continue the story of the Cremona document that I talk about in Cryptic Code. And just for that one chapter alone, it's worth buying the book. But there's another set of documents, and then there's also the Pike letters that Bill Mann discovered several years ago that still have not been published. But I will tell you that Brother Pike, he knew all about the Templars in America. He participated in Midday Wind rituals. There's a lot of support for everything I've told you tonight, and a lot more to come. Lewis and Clark is a whole nother part to that story that nobody knows about. And
that sounds interesting.
Nice.
Bill's information is fascinating too.
Oh, absolutely. Bill has written an awful lot about the Templars in America, and Bill and I correspond. We're very close friends. All of us are good friends. And, you know, Bill right now is the current Supreme Grand Master for all of Canada right now. His term is right now. He'll be in that position for at least another year and a half. So Bill is enlightened. Bill is also half indigenous. He's half Ojibwa. And what's interesting, Bill didn't know that he was native at all until he was an adult, because his mother didn't want to tell him, because she was worried that he would be abused. And because the way the natives were treated here and still mistreated in our country, it's worse in Canada. So she didn't even tell him until he was an adult. But he's basically half native and half French. He's also Mede, so he knows all about what I'm talking about. And it was because of Bill that I was invited to a Mede sweat several years ago. So I speak from experience. And I went through a ritual, and I earned the right to ask my questions. And when I did, the medicine man looked at me and said, oh, I asked him, I said, I'd like to ask you some questions about the Templars. And he said, oh, you mean our blood brothers?
Nice. That's cool.
That's and you cool. never heard anybody talk about the natives and the Templars before, have you?
No. Not until we started down this path. I mean, I said it's been really cool. So what is the chances of getting you to come back on when that book is released? So that way we can have an interview with you after we read that.
Here, man. I'll go anywhere.
Okay. So we'll have to sit there. I'll have to have somebody just come over that, you know, what's that? I think there's a grizzly or something like grizz. It's like where you can have alcohol delivered. So we'll have to sit and grow it and have it delivered to your front door. Just say, you know, courtesy of Three Beards. And what's this? It's a reminder for the show date. And here's the beard for it. There you go. There you go. The Hooked X. That's cool.
It's on the side.
One of a kind piece there.
Wow. Yep,
and then
the Knights.
Cross of Lorraine.
Wow.
Yeah, there you go.
That is cool.
Anyway, I thought you'd get a kick out of that. We're talking about the Hooked X.
That is cool. Well, Scott Walter, thank you so much. Everybody go to hookedx.com, get your signed copy book, get that out here. Especially if I said I'm probably going to try to get that cryptic code of the Templars because, you know, trying to get my reading list down, but I need to add something to the stack. So that seems like a pretty good place to jump on right there. So,
well, pop me an email. I can probably get you a copy for having me on the show. It's be more than happy to do that.
Oh, we wouldn't turn that down. Absolutely not.
Thank you, brother. Appreciate that one.
You got it, Chris.
Tell the wife, thank you so much for, you know, like I said, help, all the help, you know, and coming on the show herself, you know, and you just get there. I just sharing your, you know, her time with you, with us. So we really appreciate that. And, you know, be well. Like I said, we will definitely be in touch. And I said, thanks again for coming on.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. And, hey, we'll cross paths again soon.
Look forward to it.
All right.
All right. Have a great night.
Have a night.
Bye, guys.
Thank you.
All right, this episode was brought to you by Brott's Beard Care, premium beard oil made right here in Central Florida by local craftsmen, expertly blended by Kelly Brott, brottsbeardcare.com, promo code 3beards with a capital B. And you, like I said, that signature blend of ours has been getting great reviews. Everybody has absolutely loved that blend. He's got a couple new seasonal ones coming out. Go to Nanny Cakes 407. On Facebook or call her at 407-923-2898 here in the Central Florida area. Mention Three Beards. You're going to save a little bit of money on that cake at 15%. And that's a pretty amazing savings. So give her a call, let her know you heard about it from us. Go to threebeardspodcast.com and all the socials, Instagram, Twitter, obviously Facebook and YouTube. If you're watching this, like, subscribe, share. Go and patreon.com/threebeardspodcast. Become one with us beardos. We would love you for it.
Please, please, Mark, if you're listening, ding that bell.
Mark,
please ding that bell.
Mark Eddie, our secret agent boogeyman, thank you so much for all your help, sir, all your support. You can listen to them on Blog Talk Radio at Nightlight. He is the host there. Barbara tries to keep him wrangled in. You know, sometimes she succeeds, sometimes she doesn't. But it makes for a great show. So, you know, just and
we
you
work
can hear
well together.
Yeah, we like to pirate, you know, as many guests off of them as we can. You know, we let them do the groundwork and then we but only because Mark has been so gracious and helped us out. So, you know, we owe Mark and Barbara debt of gratitude.
Oh, this is just I really enjoy getting together with the beardos from time to time.
Yeah, we appreciate that.
I have to tell that funny story one day with the permission of Craig.
Which one's that?
When Mark emailed you, I have to tell the story one day.
Oh, go for it.
Okay, so Mark,
we can do it real quick.
Craig. So when you email me, when you email Craig, Craig calls me that day. Craig says, "This guy emailed me, and he sounds like a sales pitch. He's like, I can help you, blah blah blah." I'm like, "Craig, let it go. Email him back and just see what he got to say." Craig says, "No, he says he wants to do it for free as long as we don't exploit his guests." I says, "Okay, if you would have never emailed him back, we would have never found Mark." And it turned out to be a great partnership. I greatly appreciate you. But I'm like, yep. Craig, just email him back. Just hit him back.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, Max connected us. So that he owes, just if you don't like what we're doing, just send your hate mail to Max.
he's been a great guest too. That was, man. It's just weird.
Olaf and his shark tail going by the bottom of the screen last week. And
well, that's where the complaint department is. He just tells you to tie a stake around your neck and jump into the ocean. You know, his representative will see you shortly. So, all right, Mark, we'll appreciate it. Everybody, thank you for watching. You know, once again, Scott Walter, you know, can't thank you enough. That was an amazing interview. We had a great time. Everybody, we will see you next Wednesday. We got a couple another good guests lined up, and everybody have a great night. See you.